We'll now hear from the government. I should remember how to pronounce your names. Wojcielinski?
Laura Shebelinski Finn.
Okay.
That's okay. PRZY, who knows?
Oh.
South side of Milwaukee. Recognizing that there are lots of issues, lots of facts, lots of evidence in this case, the government is going to rely in large part on its brief in the arguments therein and also in the detailed facts set forth therein. But I'd like to start with Mr. Kelly's argument first, and that is whether or not the district court should have given Mr. Acosta Jr. acceptance of responsibility in this case. And Mr. Kelly contends that he should have been given that reduction for two reasons. First, that his argument was not a frivolous denial of relevant conduct. And second, that even if it was the attorney's argument not adopted by Mr. Acosta Jr. The government concedes that if this court finds that this was not a frivolous denial of relevant conduct, then certainly this should be remanded and the court should consider whether Mr. Acosta Jr. should get credit for acceptance of responsibility. Because if it truly is a legal argument, which the government does not believe it is, but if it truly is, then in fact acceptance wouldn't be in play at that point. But I'd like to talk about why we believe this is a frivolous denial of relevant conduct, and we said it many times before. This challenge at its base is that Spring Acosta is a liar. Simple. What does that mean? That means that the defendant must have a different version of the truth. So if the witnesses are liars, Spring Acosta, then the government hasn't met its burden. If the witnesses are truth tellers, then the government has met its burden. It's a factual dispute at its very base level.
So your point is just, you know, if we assume that the bar is up here for meeting the government's burden of proof, the only way the government doesn't meet it is if you delete Spring's testimony.
Yes.
Effectively.
Okay. Exactly. And that's the basic argument on behalf of the defendant is poking holes in Spring Acosta's testimony, testimony that the district court heard and reviewed, and Mr. Kelly had trial transcripts of. Judge Crabb thought very carefully about this and found Ms. Acosta to be credible. So I don't know how it gets any more of a factual dispute. So starting at that point that the government believes this is a frivolous denial of relevant conduct, as the district court did, then the question is, did the district court have to do more in order to deny Mr. Acosta Jr. acceptance of responsibility?
Well, and there's also the question that we've struggled with in cases like Purchase and Lister. What you're describing is a point that I hope people who have finished law school understand well and could describe, but it's certainly not the kind of thing that you would expect a layperson, such as a criminal defendant, to know. You know, the difference between did you have a question of fact about burden of proof? Did you have a question about which building blocks go into meeting the burden of proof? Do you have an argument of law? They're not the most obvious things. And so to deprive the defendant of that adjustment there might be some question about how much does the defendant have to understand.
But it is precisely why the defendant has a lawyer and why we expect good lawyers like Mr. Kelly to talk to their clients, to explain the risks of certain objections, to discuss the case, to discuss, as in this case, the letter that the government wrote saying that it was going to withdraw its recommendation for acceptance of responsibility if they persisted.
So could I ask you, and I certainly don't mean to be personal about anybody who's in the courtroom today, but if a lawyer frivolously contested relevant conduct and thereby did something that resulted in the client getting a significantly longer sentence, which we know from the Supreme Court means anything longer, I take it then on a 2255 for ineffective assistance of counsel, the defendant would have a good claim.
Precisely, and I think that's exactly where this argument belongs. Because here, the real risk is invading the attorney-client privilege at a point where, in fact, in Lister, Mr. Kelly stopped Judge Shabazz and said, Your Honor, you're going too far asking him those questions. You're invading attorney-client privilege. So what do? I think Purchase worked well for Purchase. Purchase had a fifth-grade education. He could barely speak English. He expressed extreme confusion at the sentencing hearing. The hearing was adjourned for some period of time to try to clear things up. I can understand how that opinion ended up the way it did. But I don't think it translates very easily into other sentencing hearings, as was clear, I think, from Lister.
Lister was being cagey, if you will. I mean, he simply refused to grapple with it. We don't have anything like that kind of exchange in this case.
No, we don't, but nor do we have a person with a fifth grade education who appeared to be confused at all. What we have is Mr. Acosta Jr., who does have a high school equivalency diploma. He's very proud of that. He told that to the judge during the sentencing hearing. He's got some education beyond that he hopes to resume at some later point. The United States warned, if you will, the defendant that if they persisted in this frivolous denial of relevant conduct, the government was going to withdraw its recommendation for acceptance. Now, I think we have to assume that a good lawyer discusses that with their client. And I understand Mr. Kelly's footnote where he indicates, look, I didn't ask for a purchase-type inquiry because my argument was this was legal, it wasn't factual. So there would have been no reason for me to have the judge do that. But Mr. Kelly well knew this was in play. He well knew that acceptance was on the line here. And it seems to me that a good lawyer is going to have that discussion with their client, and we should expect that. Because let's look at what would happen in this particular case. What should Judge Crabb have done if we follow along Mr. Kelly's argument? Well, Mr. Acosta Jr., you've heard us talking for the last 35 minutes about drug amounts and about acceptance of responsibility and those sorts of things. And I know you're sitting next to Mr. Kelly. Do you agree with him? How do you feel about him? What kinds of conversations did you have to give you confidence in your attorney?
How about, you know, just do you understand if you persist in this argument, then I will not be in a, you know, you may be risking an acceptance of responsibility adjustment?
That question certainly was not asked.
Very straightforward. It's not too complicated.
I agree, but I do think that it starts, if the judge is really going to get into a realistic inquiry, because what's a defendant going to say? He's sitting next to his lawyer. The arguments are being made. These are factual arguments based on the guidelines, and a defendant, I think we have to assume that a defendant is relying on their attorney, as Mr. Lister continued to say, and I think if at some later point Mr. Acosta Jr. maintains, look, he never talked to me about this. He never told me this was a risk. I do think that that's more appropriately placed in a 2255 motion. And let's face it, what happens if there is a remand on this issue? The remand is for the judge to ask the question. And let's assume, for sake of argument, that this court accepts the district court's finding that it's 1.5 kilograms of crack and that this would be a frivolous denial of relevant conduct. How does this go? Judge Crabb says, well, Mr. Acosta Jr., you realize that this would be a frivolous denial of relevant conduct. So how do you now feel about your attorney's position? Well, any attorney worth their salt is going to advise their client that he better say, you know what, that didn't seem like such a hot idea. I disagree. We're putting defendants and their attorneys butting heads in this situation, and I think that this is really more appropriately placed in a 2255. I think it could just lead to lots of problems. I also think that Mr. Acosta Jr. is closer to Mr. Lister in terms of his ability to understand what was going on than Mr. Purchase was.
There was a brief colloquy between the judge and Mr. Acosta about whether he had read the pre-sentence and had any objections to add over and above what those that had already been made, something to that effect?
Absolutely. Judge Crabb starts all of her sentencing hearings out advising the defendant of their right to appeal, discussing whether or not the defense attorney is appointed, explaining to the defendant that they can continue to have that attorney, and then also asking the defendant whether they've read the PSR, whether or not they have any objections in addition to those filed by their counsel. That's where Mr. Purchase got confused. He had no idea what Judge Shabazz was asking him, it would appear. You know, in contrast to that, Mr. Acosta Jr. answered, you know, yes, he understood all of those things. What we're really talking about is perhaps one more question, but what if that question's not enough? And then I really do think you are invading the attorney-client privilege, or at least there is an argument to be made for that.
Although you do recognize it's a little odd for the government to be here, you know, defending the attorney-client privilege of the other side, as opposed to letting them worry about how that's going to work out on their own. But I had three questions that I wanted to ask you, and if you can, since time is going to slip away, two of them have to do with Mr. Fairbanks, and one of them has to do with Mr. Zamora. And Mr. Fairbanks' lawyer, unfortunately, is ill and would have been here, but but for that fact. In his case, it has to do with the enhancements, number one, for the use of minors, and number two, for the guns. And I wonder what evidence the government has that shows that Fairbanks himself used, in the sense that this court has recently said in Spring Acosta's appeal, as it happens, that he used the minors as part of this operation.
The way that Spring Acosta and Donald Fairbanks were involved with minors was a little bit different.
I'm just saying the legal standard set forth in this court's decision, United States versus Acosta, decided February 5th of this year, is a standard that contemplates a very active and personal kind of use. It's not a Pinkerton kind of use. This court specifically rejects that kind of analysis of the concept of use. And so what I want to know is what evidence is there for Mr. Fairbanks that he is using the minors in the way that we have now defined that term?
As the government set forth in its brief, the way that we believe that Mr. Fairbanks used minors was the fact that he participated with Ray Quagan and Michael Blackdear, the two minors mainly involved in this case, in packaging crack cocaine at the Yvonne Dennis household, that he was with them. They were all together, and we believe that that shows that he encouraged that behavior. I believe encouraged is one of the terms used in Acosta. I wasn't sure we were going to argue Fairbanks because Mr. Summers wasn't here, but the government's brief sets forth really all the facts that we've got that tie.
But that's when I looked back into the PSR at those facts, I don't find quite the spin on things, I guess, that you're saying. I mean, in the PSR, it says, for example, Zamora and Fairbanks distributed drugs to customers and also to other dealers, including the two minors, Ray Quagan and Michael Blackdear. But that doesn't say Fairbanks distributed to them. There's this long list of people, Nick Thayer, Bobby Smith, Anthony Gouge, Ray Quagan, and Michael Blackdear. So I don't find that as evidence that links up Mr. Fairbanks with the minors. And I also can't see where it shows the minors helping Fairbanks package the crack, because you go back and look at the minors' statements, they don't actually mention Mr. Fairbanks. So
you're correct that the facts lump a whole bunch of folks together at the Yvonne Dennis residence, doing things with crack, packaging it, selling it. Donald Fairbanks was there on many occasions.
The minors weren't using him. I mean, honestly, I just don't see where we have something that sort of tips us over that 50% mark, you know, that he used the minors.
Your Honor, I think that what the facts show is that Mr. Fairbanks worked together with the minors, and we view that as an encouragement. But certainly there isn't some earth-shattering evidence that Mr. Fairbanks called upon these minors and directed them to do something. You're correct.
So you think, even under our Acosta decision, sort of standing side by side with somebody, maybe never even saying a word, no evidence of any conversation, you think that would fit what we have now set forth in the United States against Acosta?
Well, in this particular case, they did all work very closely together. It wasn't an assembly line.
Answer my question, though. You think, you know, A and B are standing next to each other. A is above the age of 18. B is 16. No one says a word to each other. You think that's A using B?
I think it could be if they're involved in the same criminal activity, as in this case, Mr. Fairbanks was convicted of maintaining that drug house, and the Ray Quagan and Michael Blackdear both worked out of that drug house. So I do think that leap could be made in this case, although I recognize it's not strong in light of Acosta.
Okay. And how about the guns for Mr. Fairbanks?
The guns for Mr. Fairbanks are found in the Chapter 2 adjustments, and I think that's a huge distinction between the minors found in Chapter 3. I do think that the guns are something that each person in the conspiracy, if it was reasonably foreseeable that these guns were being used, I think they can be held accountable for them, and I think they should. Granted, Mr. Fairbanks, of the three that I think appealed this issue, Mr. Fairbanks, there's no evidence that Mr. Fairbanks ever held the gun, but he certainly was at all these meetings and aware of them, just as the original argument on the minors went. But I think that for the guns, because of their placement in the guidelines, are attributable to those in the conspiracy for whom it was reasonably foreseeable. And if I could just make one point about the guns, Mr. Barragan also appeals the gun issue, and I would just like to point out that he received credit for his conviction for those guns because it was viewed as relevant conduct. If they're no longer viewed as relevant conduct for Mr. Barragan, and I think it's highly unlikely seeing as he had the guns, but if that were taken away, then he would go down 2 points, but he'd still be at 360 to life because his criminal history category would go up to 5, and then Judge Crabb need not credit his current time that he's serving on that gun enhancement. So I don't know that Mr. Barragan's attorneys thought that through. I just want to throw that out there so it's out there.
The largest collective sentencing issue here is this 1.5 kilograms of crack. What's your best and strongest evidence on that? And I understand that some of the defendants are implicated for longer time periods and shorter time periods, et cetera. But
and that's part of it. I think Ms. Moores had made the point that this is all about witnesses and witness credibility. This case, as Mr. Vaudry was wont to say throughout, this was proved the old-fashioned way. It was witness after witness after witness. And that's
what about the powder in the crack? I mean, I guess that's part of the 1.5 issue. It needs to be crack for the threshold that you're looking at.
Right. I think one thing to consider, first of all, is that this conspiracy started in January of 1999. It went through the end of 2003. So there's a huge amount of time period here.
But the same time isn't necessarily – people join at different times, and the scope of what's reasonably foreseeable to people seems to vary defendant by defendant here.
It does. And even so, this 1.5 calculation is extremely conservative. I know it doesn't sound that way because it's a huge number. But in fact, Judge Crabb found at many of these sentencings that it was well over 1.5 kilos. And again, this was based on witness credibility. Judge Crabb looked at basically 4 witnesses who were in the thick of things, who were all convicted in federal court and are facing and have been sentenced based on these very same drug amounts they talked about. You've got Spring Acosta, Candace Rademacher, Becky Corbine, and Jacqueline Martinson. These are the women who testified about the drug amounts, who talked to law enforcement about the drug amounts. Well, they had no protection on those statements. They went through trips. They painstakingly talked about, you know, how often, during what time periods. And what the government did in preparation for sentencing, argued at sentencing, and what Judge Crabb accepted, is tried to break up these time periods and go through witness by witness, citing to the record, citing to the trial testimony, you know, whether it was Spring Acosta saying it was mostly formed, whether it was Becky Corbine saying it was at least an ounce, you know, during this time period, and during that time period it was 3 to 4 ounces, half of it was crack. This stuff was cooked into crack. It was then sold on the reservation. There were no shortage of crackheads for witnesses in this trial either. I mean, these people were buying crack. They know what crack was. They used it. And to try to go through each number considered by Judge Crabb now, I don't think we have enough time. But our brief does try to go through how she came to these amounts. And I'd like to point out just a couple of things about it. These were the lowest estimates. If a trip was once every 1 to 2 weeks, it was once every 2 weeks. If it was Spring Acosta saying mostly formed crack, it was half. So we tried to bring it back so that it was conservative. And even so, Judge Crabb found, I think without question, in each of these sentences that it was well over 1.5. We use 1.5, which is a little misleading, because that's the most that the guidelines consider. That's a level 38. That's as high as you go. But a lot of times we were at 3 kilos. This wasn't like 1.5 and a half. So we took witness statements, looked at those, broke them down, and the best everybody could, tried to figure out what the amounts were. And Judge Crabb really painstakingly went through this evidence. She considered the arguments of the defendants, and she came up with this amount and was confident that not only was it 1.5 kilos, but it was well over that. I think she made her reasons very clear. She based them on witness testimony, and I don't think that her findings can be clearly erroneous on that issue.
Now, can we go back to Pedro Zamora for a minute? Because I'm also concerned about the government's definition of what it takes to maintain a crack house. Because surely maintaining a crack house has to mean something more than sleeping there from time to time. I can imagine easily, for example, that Yvonne Dennis was maintaining a crack house in this, but I don't see, and maybe somebody else who really lived there most of the time, maybe the daughter Sasha, but Mr. Zamora, unless maintaining means you kind of tag base, I'm not sure how he's maintaining a crack house.
Well,
he's selling crack sometimes in the house.
Well, he's selling crack pretty regularly during a time period.
So he's availing himself of the service of the crack house, but he's not maintaining the crack house.
Well, Mr. Zamora is the one person besides Sasha Dennis that lives there.
Live there regularly.
Consistently during a given time period, he lived there. Yvonne Dennis indicated he had nowhere else to stay. Sasha Dennis said he stayed there most of the time, although she didn't know if he showered there. But he was there with regularity. People expected him to be there. He sold crack out of a little window there. When he wasn't there, Sasha Dennis sold for him.
And do you have no distinction at all between maintaining the crack house and being one of the people who uses the crack house?
Well, in United States...
The word maintain to me just means like you're the one who's running it. You are the one or ones. I certainly recognize it could be a couple of people maintaining house. Could it be Yvonne Dennis and Sasha? It could be in a different case, you know, a couple of brothers, or it could be, I'm not thinking that it needs to be just one person, but if all of the people who come in and spend 5 minutes and sell a little crack in there are all maintaining it, it seems to me the government's stretching this word pretty far.
I would agree if Mr. Zamora's conduct in that house was coming there, spending 5 minutes there and selling crack there, but that's not what the evidence showed. What the evidence showed was that during a given time period, about a 7-month time period, Pedro Zamora was there regularly. And remember, he was charged along with other folks with maintaining that crack house, John Rademacher, Candy Rademacher, and Donald
Fairbanks. Those appeals are not all before us. I am not sure they all maintained it. He's there some of the time, but I don't know that being there equals maintaining.
Well, Your Honor, we did cite to United States versus Gardner for the premise that if you are taking part in the crack house and making it work and having crack available to people when they come to the crack house,
that's a conspiracy case, right?
It certainly is a conspiracy case, but he was charged jointly with other folks, and I think that you don't need a conspiracy charge per se to say they were helping each other out. I mean, he actively sold crack out of there. He stayed there. People expected him to be there. Becky Corbine knew that's where she could find him, at least one of the places she could find him to deliver crack. There was only two places discussed at trial that I recall that Mr. Zamora was ever at, and that's at Yvonne Dennis's and at Donald Fairbanks.
But, you know, the 11th Circuit and its Clavis decision seems to say that selling regularly from a particular place is not the same thing as maintaining.
And I think the distinction with Mr. Zamora is that he did stay there. He was living there. And while maybe he wasn't sleeping over there every night, he did stay there with regularity. He packaged crack there.
He doesn't have dominion and control. He's living there because she lets him in, because, as you say, he has nowhere else. The 11th Circuit also talks about that and says living is a helpful factor, but it's how are you living there?
And certainly it's one of a number of factors, but I think that when you look at Mr. Zamora really wasn't selling crack out of any place else that anyone pointed to at trial.
I'm just selling, to me, isn't the same thing as maintaining the house.
And it's the government's position that he was one of a number of people who did maintain and support the crack business at the Dennis household. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like a drive-through just about. He did sell out of that window. And again, when he wasn't going to be there, he made arrangements for Sasha to take care of his customers. So I do think that that in this case, viewed in the light most favorable to the government, that the facts add up to the fact that Mr. Zamora did maintain that.
Well, it depends on the legal definition of maintain, I think. If it means what you say it means, which is just sell a lot of stuff out of it, you know, or be one of the regular sellers in, then I think you're right. Viewing the facts most favorably to the government, he certainly did that. But if maintain means something more like you're the one who pays the electric bills, you're the one who keeps it open, you're the one who makes sure that people are there that day, you're the one, in a sense, who is running the operation, I don't see him in that role.
And I think that with Mr. Zamora, he falls somewhere in between, and I think he falls at a place where it still qualifies as maintaining, although recognizing that he certainly didn't pay the bills in that house.
Mm-hmm. Was there any evidence that he had some other home during that seven-month period?
There wasn't. There was testimony that he did stay with Donald Fairbanks every once in a while, but everyone knew him to be over at the Yvonne Dennis house, best I can recall. I was not lead counsel, but I did second chair the trial, so I did sit through the entire trial. And as I recall, I don't remember any other testimony that he had any other place to go, and that was Yvonne Dennis's testimony as well. And if the court has no other questions, I just ask that this court affirm the judgment and convictions of the district court.
Okay. Thank you very much. A number of you had reserved time for rebuttal. I show Ms. Ralston, Mr. Birdsall, Mr. Schnacki, and Mr. Kelly. And so we'll take you. If you ran out, I'll still give you a minute.
Your Honor, just very briefly, obviously the government didn't make any mention of our argument, so I don't know whether that means that they're just conceding it or not. I'm assuming not.
I think they're resting on their brief for the things they didn't mention.
And that's why I want to just point out that in the brief, there are some factual misstatements about what Judge Crabb used to determine the amount for Nicholas Acosta. And there was this lumping of everyone together. And clearly, there probably was more than 1.5 kilograms during the period from 1999 to 2003. But again, zeroing in on the short period of time that Nicholas Acosta was at all involved in this, and the judge said it was peripheral involvement, the only evidence, and the government does have a burden of showing some evidence as to amounts. And the only evidence, and I'm not disputing Spring Acosta's credibility here. I mean, I think it can be disputed, but just even accepting what she said does not amount to 1.5 kilograms of either crack or powder cocaine or any combination of that. The judge did not make any findings about any specific amounts or even estimated amounts for anything else, even the shorter, the additional time period that Nicholas was involved in this. So I think that it's very clear that this has to be sent back to the court to make some fact findings. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Birdsall?
I'm just going to pick up where I left off, discussing January of 2002 to May of 2002, where the district court found Mr. Berrigan responsible for 1,134 grams of crack based exclusively on the finding that that he had given a referral source to Ms. Martinson, and then Ms. Martinson and Ms. Corbine are off to the races. And it's the district court's assertion at sentencing that he had to know that she was going to become this major supplier because he had made trips with her in the past. Well, two points. One is that the trips in the past, there was no linkage or no connection whatsoever from anybody's personal knowledge, including Ms. Martinson, that there was any drugs in those trips in the past. They were boyfriend-girlfriend. They had a son together. They traveled between sets of relatives so the grandparents could see the child. And she grew up in the LCO. He grew up in Milwaukee. It's a natural connection. So that's number one. And number two is that, and again, as I pointed out, there's three other circuits that have adopted this rule, that Mr. Berrigan cannot be automatically held responsible for the acts of a third party, Ms. Martinson. And I think it's a wrong assumption on the part of the district court to say, as she did at the sentencing, that he had given her, quote, information, and that this was a motivation for her to continue dealing. She didn't need any motivation. She had sources of her own. She had customers of her own that she admitted at trial. And my time is up, so thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Mr. Schnacki, you can have a minute.
I will pick up also where Mr. Berrigan's counsel left off on behalf of Mr. Castillo, only to say that the alleged connection between Mr. Castillo and Ms. Corbine was even more tenuous. There was no child together. The testimony is very clear. They spent one night together at some point in time well before Becky Corbine was involved in selling drugs. The government made an interesting point. They said when the court made inquiry as to how you got to that 1.5 kilograms, they said there were four witnesses, Spring, Acosta, or LeSueur, Candy Rademacher, Becky Corbine, and Jackie Martinson. And earlier when they were talking about Mr. Kelly's argument, they said, well, witnesses are either truth-tellers or liars. Well, those four witnesses were not in accord, and that's exactly one of the major deficits in the court's findings, is the court did not resolve the contradictions between those witnesses. Very specifically, Candy Rademacher saying that the conspiratorial activity took place at a different discrete period of time. She said, and contradicted Corbine's testimony, specifically that the Rademachers were involved in a later period, that being a period that was then attributed to Mr. Castillo and others. That being said, I think it's when the lack of resolution is a primary problem.
Sure. Thank you. And last, Mr. Kelly, you can have one final word.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's true, as Judge Sykes pointed out in questioning the government, that the Judge Crabb asked Mr. Acosta whether he had read the pre-sentence report, but it's important to understand that she did not take the next step and ask him whether he read my objections to the pre-sentence report or whether he understood those objections, and that's what Purchase suggests the court should do. Now, the government argues that this court should just assume, or that Judge Crabb was okay in just assuming that he understood those objections because he has counsel. But the Purchase decision made a point of saying that we shouldn't infer from the defendant's silence that he understands or accepts counsel's objections. In fact, Purchase says that the court has to have a reason to attribute an attorney's statements to an otherwise silent defendant, and it suggests that the way the court does that is to question the otherwise silent defendant to determine if the defendant understands and adopts the attorney's statements, challenging facts underlying possibly relevant conduct. So I think in Purchase, the court rejected the government's position that the court should simply assume or infer acceptance from silence. The court has to take the next affirmative step and find out what the defendant knows and what the defendant accepts. And if the defendant doesn't adopt the argument, then the court shouldn't take away acceptance of responsibility. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to all counsel. You were all court appointed, is that right? We appreciate very much your help to us with this case and your service to your client. Thank you to the government as well, and we will take this case under advisement.